Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for In the News, our regular dive into the news stories that have been around this past couple of weeks. And with me, two men who are feeling very ill. They've got election fever. It is John Stevens, our National Director. Good morning, John.
Hi, Phil.
And our Head of National Ministries, Adrian Reynolds. Good
Welcome
morning,
back,
Adrian.
Phil. Excellent. I'd like to say it wasn't the same without you.
Well, it was a lot better.
Yes. I listened back and I was pleased you'd given me a year off to recover from a debacle.
It was very traumatic.
In a football match. Yeah, that's what it is. I did say to one of my colleagues, it'd be great if I just didn't turn up till next June because I'd listened to what you'd said on the podcast. I was at the North Wales local conference a couple of weeks ago. Great time thinking about just justification in our local conferences. And John, you were at Gloucester earlier in the week.
I was in Gloucester, kind of local conference at Trinity Church in Gloucester. Kind of Gareth Lewis, our South Wales director, was speaking. It was a great time gathering leaders together. Again, for me, just really striking speaking to a couple of leaders, including at Trinity Gloucester, people reporting church growth. Mm-hmm. So again, people saying people are coming to church. Again, some remarkable stories of people coming off the street. Someone was sharing with me that there was a kind of family walking past the church and their 9-year-old daughter said, I want to go in there. And the family came
amazing.
In and now they're coming back and now they're doing Christianity Explored.
Fantastic.
I mean, again, as in lots and lots of other places, growing ethnic diversity. Mm. So churches that pre-COVID would have had very little ethnic diversity are suddenly seeing kind of the nations coming to church. So I think lots and lots of people were in really good heart and actually sort of addressing the challenges of growth. More difficult in smaller churches in rural contexts, still some circumstances where revitalization is needed. But it was just great to get together and think about what justification means for ministry and our sure status in Christ.
Interesting what you're saying there about church reporting conversions. I was at a church in Exeter over the weekend looking to join FIEC, and they talked to me about a whole group of people who'd gathered together to do Christianity Explored. All of them got saved and are now a church home group. Isn't that a great story? It's just great things like that happening.
I mean,
it is
common. It's not universal.
No.
So one or two people said to me, I've heard you say this on the podcast a few times, we're not experiencing that. And it's, you know, so don't say it's universal. So it's not universal. Mm. The Lord is at work, but the Spirit blows where he wills. Mm. And some churches are struggling and finding life is difficult post-COVID still. So there are some general patterns which we really rejoice in, but you may be listening to this and think, well, that's not happening to me. Mm. But we do need to learn to rejoice, don't we, with others who are rejoicing, as well as mourning with those who mourn.
And I think it's worth saying sort of where it's not happening doesn't mean you're doing anything wrong.
No,
Actually, it's not actually that any of these churches are doing anything exceptional, different, or they've discovered something that's going to make all of the difference. It's the Lord happens to be blessing at particular places at particular times. And that, I think, is why it's so important that we think of the church as being more than just my local individual church. Mm. The work of evangelism, the work of the gospel is done by the people of God and the church as a whole. And that ability to be able to rejoice with those who are rejoicing and also mourn with those who are struggling and having difficulties is absolutely crucial. Mm. And I think one of the reasons FIEC exists is to enable churches to have that sense of belonging to the much wider work of God.
Yeah, that's right.
And we need to rejoice in kingdom growth wherever it is and keep praying that God would be at work in all places.
I recommend Psalm 126. John preached on Psalm 126 last Sunday and at our local church, and it's online. We'll put the link in the notes. I do recommend it. We reflected on that in our small group this week and found it really helpful to be thinking about just, you know, stories around the world where the gospel is growing, and let's rejoice in that because the Lord is answering that prayer.
And it's not just here, it's around the world as well.
That's right, right.
The Lord's doing things across the nations, isn't
around
he?
The world far more than
exactly.
here. And again, at one level, you might say what we've just talked about within our own churches on a global scale is even more so.
Yeah, the church is advancing.
Yeah, the Lord is at work. And one of the great ways we can hear about that is at the Leaders Conference. A couple more weeks to get the early bird booking.
That's right. You've got the fingers, you've got your fingers on the pulse of how much it's going to save you.
Last day of June, you can save up to £40 on your ticket.
There you go. It's all coming together. I'm very excited. The program's basically finalized. And a really good range of seminars, a really good range of speakers. I always think if I want to go to every seminar, that's a really good test. Mm. And I do. Mm. So there you go.
Excellent. Well, you'll look forward to listening to them all because they'll all be online afterwards, won't they? Let's talk about the news for a few minutes.
Sure.
Donald Trump was convicted this week. We're not going to dive into that in depth. We've talked about Donald Trump before. We will put a link in the show notes to an interview you did, John, with TWR, which I think encapsulates everything you probably want to say here. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's about 15 minutes. It's not too long.
Not too long, but it's well worth listening to if you want to hear comments on that. So it's John did an interview with TWR, and that will be in the show notes. And let's talk about a really poignant week, remembering the Second World War, the commemorations, the 80th anniversary of D-Day, an extraordinary sacrifice that so many made to give us the freedoms that we enjoy today. And some really poignant audio, pictures, things we've seen from the Normandy beaches this week. Just reflecting on how incredible it was for so many to give up their lives for the freedoms we enjoy today.
Yeah, I mean, it was an extraordinary moment. Just a point of clarification, the actual casualties on D-Day were not as high as actually were expected. If you look at the Battle of Normandy, the 45 days afterwards, and you look at the battle as a whole, the casualties were very high, especially at some moments. But actually, it was so well organised and so well planned, which in itself is a lesson, that in some places, casualties were remarkably light. Mm. So the capturing of what is now called Pegasus Bridge, just outside Wistram, on the eastern flank, by the Oxen Bucks, their glider assault was sort of almost went without, you know, kind of without incident. One person died, the first person to die actually on D-Day, and Den Brotheridge, and actually it was so well planned. They trained for it for a year. And if you ever read the book, by the way, by Stephen Ambrose called Pegasus Bridge, about John Howard, who was the major who led that assault, it's just some great lessons in leadership. However, it was very costly. It involved huge numbers of people, not just those who were fighting, but those who were behind. I think one of the most moving things that I saw actually was the lady who made the maps. Hmm. Who is 103, I think, isn't she? Given the Christine Lam, is that her name? Given the Légion d'honneur by President Macron. Hmm. So just a reminder that actually there are a whole number of people working in the background. I mean, just we could do a whole, but maybe we should, a whole episode on it. I just think there's so many lessons for us. There are lots of similarities, you see, between church life and the military fighting, because it is a battle. Yeah. But yes, it is moving, Phil, and it's moving to see people who are. The youngest person, I think, who was there as a veteran was 98. Mm. So it'll be the last time really they're there celebrating. It's moving to see leaders, you know, actually genuinely their kind of hearts pouring out for what's going on. Mm. There's a picture of the Queen, tears in her eyes. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it is very moving to see the cost of the freedoms that we enjoy.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's ever more poignant because of the veterans and their age and the diminishing number. I mean, I remember the kind of 40th celebrations in 1984. I remember watching that on the television, and then veterans were probably 65 to 70. There were huge numbers who had been involved, some of the leading figures, those who'd taken part in Pegasus Bridge, kind of raid. So there is a sense that an era of history is passing. And it is incredibly sort of poignant to try to think about and take in the extent of the sacrifice that was involved here. I mean, for many of us, it's just really hard to imagine Europe engulfed in war, an enemy as evil as the Nazis in terms of what they did, how they treated people, the fact that is within living memory, that Europe was engulfed in this terrible conflict. I guess it's brought home a little bit more this year because of what's going on in Ukraine.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we, for the first time, really see Europe again engulfed in war. So I think you're right. Battle of Normandy was terrible, something like 45,000 casualties. The casualty rate was the same amongst the Allies as at the Battle of Passchendaele in the First World War. But 31,000 Ukrainians at least have been killed fighting the kind of Russian invasion. So that just puts some sort of context in terms of what's happening in Europe at the moment. And obviously D-Day was a tremendous kind of Allied effort, the British, the Americans, the Canadians. One should never forget that actually the Germans were sort of in large part defeated because of the terrible conflict that took place on the Eastern Front and the sacrifices made by the Russians. That sort of at the same time that D-Day was going on, there were immense battles kind of unfolding on the Eastern Front that involved far more troops, far more tanks, far more casualties. So it was the whole continent was engulfed in this terrible struggle. And to hear from these kind of men who were young, who kind of landed on the beach, who risked their lives, who were surrounded by sort of friends who didn't make it, I just think that's incredibly moving.
Mm. It was a wonderful moment on the Today programme yesterday where a 98-year-old veteran was being pressed by Nick Robinson to say, well, you know, young people today, it was all 18-year-olds, you know, young people today wouldn't step up in quite the same way. And this 98-year-old veteran wonderfully said, oh, I think they would. And I think we can be very, very negative about a younger generation. But actually, when crisis comes, people do stand up, don't they, and be counted as that generation did.
And when we think about sacrifice, I think that, again, it's hearing the living individuals and sort of trying to understand something of what it really meant for them. You can read it as history and it's an event that happened. You can read all the theory, the military strategy, and it can all be a bit abstract. And then actually it brings home the reality of the sacrifice. And I think it actually parallels with that about how we think about the cross, Jesus, our great savior. We can so easily reduce that to a theological formula and talk about it in those terms in a rather abstract way and actually fail to really think about the reality of what took place and the Lord's Supper.
Yes, that's right.
You can argue over the theology of it, the meaning of it, what happens in it. In the end, it's meant to remind us of a body broken. It's meant to remind us of real blood spilt. And I think that dimension of the real humanity, the real cost, the real pain that is involved, we mustn't miss that and we mustn't lose that.
That's right.
I think another interesting angle on this is when you think about these veterans who are still alive, who were there on the beaches yesterday, they were eyewitnesses of these events.
Right.
And this is 80 years ago. And the Gospels were written within that time period with eyewitness accounts, but yet people won't trust those accounts, yet we'll listen to every word a 98-year-old veteran will say about D-Day. But why is that, do you think? Why would people hang on every word of a 98-year-old veteran but wouldn't listen to the truthful accounts of the Gospel that were done in a much lesser time period from the events they record?
I mean, you're absolutely right. And I think it does bring home to us that the Gospels were written within the time frame of a very large number of people who witnessed the events that took place. I mean, Jesus' ministry had been public. It's recorded by other historians. There were plenty of people who would have heard Jesus teaching. There would have been sort of thousands who would have been aware of Jesus' crucifixion and the claims the disciples were making. And actually, the New Testament makes the claim these are the records either of the eyewitnesses or people who've investigated the eyewitnesses. Mm. Luke says that he's carefully investigated what took place. And yet there's an assumption that the accounts can't be kind of trusted because they're biased, because they're sort of seen as being sort of serving. I'm sure part of it is because with D-Day, we're living in the era in which we're used to film and picture recording. There's something about our kind of, this is an event that was not just within living memory, but actually there is record of it actually happening in a visual format. We've got so used to that that I think we become a little bit more skeptical about history where there isn't that supporting contemporaneous sort of video film record of what took place. And yet actually, before the invention of the camera and the film, actually eyewitness testimony written down was the way that truth was transferred from one generation to another. And the Gospels were published not just by eyewitnesses, but within a world in which there were plenty of eyewitnesses available who could have refuted those accounts. That message was preached to people who knew what had happened, and the early church grew. And I think we've got every reason to have confidence in the truthfulness of the Gospels accounts and the corroboration and the fact that they went into a world in which there were plenty of people who were aware of the events that had taken place.
One of the controversies that's come from D-Day overnight, recording on Friday morning, has been that the Prime Minister didn't stay for the whole event. That's on the front page of a couple of the papers this morning. He's now apologised quite quickly for that. So he was there. He left early, by all accounts, to come back and do a TV interview about the election. That does seem like a bit of a misstep. Good that he's apologised quickly. But what lessons can we learn for church leaders about what's happened there?
I think I think is the answer, Phil.
It's good that he apologised quickly. Good that,
I think that's the first thing to say, that he quickly acknowledged that he made a mistake and he apologised for it. And it wasn't a kind of, I apologised if it seemed to be, you know, it was a straight apology. And I think that was important. So I think that's important. You know, when we do make mistakes as leaders, and we need to acknowledge that when they're pointed out to us, I think that's very important. I think also the whole thing about how people perceive something is important. We often think about whether our motives are pure, perhaps before the Lord, whether we're doing the right thing before the Lord, and that's the thing that really counts. But I think in leadership, we've also got to be thinking all the time how things appear to others. And we don't want to be a stumbling block to people. We need to recognize that actually we might speak in a certain way. We might speak truth, but if we speak it in a certain way and some person hears it wrongly, for example, or we act in a certain way and it's misinterpreted, I just think we've got to be very careful and be sure to be clear that actually how we're seen is important to our people. It does seem to me that Rishi Sunak on a number of occasions has just lacked political judgment. I think betting over an asylum seeker, for example, and this is any comment on the policy, but whatever you think of the policy, whether it's a good thing or not, I think there are times when he lacks judgment. And it can be difficult. I think if you're in a church of a mixed group of people from all different backgrounds, it's very easy to be misunderstood. So I think we have to work hard at explaining what we're doing and why. For example, just a completely abstract example, let's say as elders in a church, you decide to change something about church. I think turning up at a church meeting saying, oh, we've decided to change this, I don't think that's good enough. I think you need to explain yourself so you're not going to be misinterpreted. So I think that's important. But yes, I just think the optics of it really are very poor. And clearly it does appear that it was a decision of his making. It hadn't been asked by ITV. It was that the Conservative Party had wanted to do the interview at that time. So it could have been avoided.
I don't think it's just about appearance. I mean, in the end, it sort of was a failing to honour the veterans and the event that was there. And at one level, it seems like you're pursuing the kind of the agenda of an election and an interview. And actually, there are things where you do have to prioritise between things. And sometimes you have to sacrifice things that you might want to do, which you think are important, because actually there's something else more significant.
That's leadership.
That you need to do. Yeah. And I think that honouring of others in this national moment was really significant. I think that's true in leadership. Sometimes I come across leaders, they get invited to speak at something. All they want to do is turn up, do their thing, leave. They don't want to engage with people because they want to go and do the other stuff that they think is really important. So they're happy to come up and be on the platform, but they're not actually happy to engage with the people. They don't want to listen to others doing things. They only want to be able to do their thing. And I just think there's something about that that's not about the way that we serve other people and we honour other people and what they're doing. Actually, we're not that important, and the thing we're doing is probably not that important compared to kind of honouring others in an appropriate way. And we might feel we're kind of wasting time, but actually that's a good investment of time in people and others. So I think it's not just an issue of kind of how it might look. It's actually about kind of choosing to honour others rather than kind of, in a sense, pursue your own self-interest. And I think in ministry, we have to make that choice all the time in order to us. I always remember Ray Evans, our leadership consultant, something he once said to us as a leadership team. I think he picked it up from Rudy Giuliani, but you have to ask him about that. He basically said, you know, effectively, sort of weddings, nobody will mind if you can't make it to a wedding, but funerals never miss them. There's a sort of a sense in which that is so important for honouring the people and those who are there. And I think little bits of wisdom like that about how we prioritise what's really significant, what's missable, what's not kind of missable. Those are just really significant decisions. Yeah.
It does depend on the size of your church, doesn't it, how that might work. But we're a reasonably small church, and one of the things we try and do is we try and make sure an elder goes to the funerals of family members, even when they're not in the church. And sometimes that requires a journey, and it sometimes requires us putting ourselves out. But actually, that's a really important way of honouring people in the church who's, let's say, a parent has died. That's happened just recently in our church, and that's actually really important.
But we have to say, most political leaders make those misjudgments. One level, it's easy to do because people are caught up in their world of what seems so immediately
and
important.
And this pulls on their time. Yeah. Absolutely, I agree with that. Well, we are in this election season. The first TV debate took place earlier in the week. Lots been said about that. What was truthful, what wasn't truthful. Lots of defending of positions. Was something misleading? Others saying it wasn't. It looks murky, doesn't it, when this kind of thing is being raked over? What can we learn about how we make sure we're as transparent as we can be as leaders?
Oh, goodness. Well, go on, John, you go first.
I was going to say, I think we're in a stage in the election campaign. The manifestos haven't been published, so we don't quite know what people are exactly promising. And I think we're in a phase in which the leaders of the various parties are making all sorts of promises of what they're going to do. So they're kind of, in a sense, producing policies that they think will appeal to their base, that will appeal to certain groups of people. It's always this stage of a little bit of a giveaway of, we're going to do this for you, we're going to do this for others. And actually generally avoiding scrutiny of how they're going to afford it. If I hear yet again somebody else saying we're going to do this, and the way we're going to do it is by cutting down on tax evasion and tax avoidance, I mean, that is the answer they always give for spending commitments. And yet actually history shows that never delivers the result. But it sounds great because it means, it implies to people, we'll give you what you want, but there won't actually be any cost to you. Or it becomes, well, we'll tax the rich more, but without defining who the rich are and who's going to get kind of caught in that. Or we're going to make cuts, but we don't tell you what those cuts are going to be. So I think we're in almost a phony war of the election at the moment, in which people are making promises that they think people will want, but they're not actually explaining the true cost of those things. I think what's depressing about our whole political debate at the moment, and actually this is sort of comment being made by people across the political spectrum, is there's a real reluctance on the part of the politicians to talk about the real challenges facing the nation.
The next government.
It is a massive challenge to have an aging population with increasing demands that flow from that, a relatively static economy, finding itself in a world context in which competition from other parts of the world is getting ever greater. We're living with some realities that are extremely difficult. And as ever, you kind of say, if the answers were simple, people would have followed them already. Nobody wants to be a government that's unpopular because you're not sorting out the problems. And so I think that there's a slight unreality of wanting to sort of make promises without really acknowledging what the costs might be that go with that.
One other thought on that, Phil, which is just on the nature of the debate. I mean, it is a race to the bottom. I was listening yesterday to a podcast that was recorded on Tuesday morning. And Danny Finkelstein, who used to be a conservative strategist, was on the podcast with Lord Mandelson and a few other people. And they were saying, the interviewer was saying, what do you hope for with the debate? And he said, whatever else, Danny Finkelstein said, whatever else that comes from the debate, I just hope they conduct themselves in a statesmanlike way. Because people hate bickering and shouting.
And that's gone, hasn't it?
It has completely gone. And I just think there is a lesson for, again, how we conduct ourselves. Even when people are having a go at us, shouting at us, railing against us, especially on social media, there is a very important lesson for how we respond, or sometimes indeed how we don't respond. You know, Christians are called to be, that there are certain characteristics. We are called to be firm about certain things and clear about doctrine, but we're also called to be, you know, if you look at the fruit of the Spirit, to be kind, to be gentle, to have self-control, and be peacemakers. And actually, I think some of these basic Christian virtues have disappeared from Christian leadership, and indeed from secular leadership. And we just need to regain those.
I think that we need to recognize there's something about the very nature of the way that these things are now conducted that makes it incredibly difficult for politicians. I do feel some sympathy.
So yes, give us 45 seconds.
What that basically means is that people have to kind of, in a sense, explain complicated and difficult things in mere sound bites. Yeah. Everything just becomes slogans shouted at each other. And at one level, there's a question of the public, sort of in a sense, almost wanting that sort of format. If people are not prepared to engage in a more extended reflection on the issues, what the alternatives might be, you will inevitably end up with that. And that is expanded into kind of billboard advertising and TikTok advertising. Everything is reduced to sort of short slogans. And I think that actually distorts the way that people can engage.
As indeed our podcast will be.
But I do think there are issues here about leadership and how you engage with leadership. And it seems to me, if we look at the ministry of Jesus and what he does, there are really three elements to it that I think stand out. Jesus is unafraid to diagnose the real problem. So he's unafraid to call sin, sin. He's unafraid to speak of the judgment to come. So actually he is not hiding the reality of what the human problem is. In fact, he's wanting to bring it completely into the light. Secondly, he wants to give hope for a better future. So actually his vision is his kingdom will come. These things will be put right. There is a way that these problems, this injustice, this oppression, this wickedness can be kind of dealt with. So it is realistic, but there's actually a hopeful vision for the future. But then he's absolutely clear that there's a cost that has to be paid for that. Yeah. So he has to pay the cost of being the one who goes to the cross and bear the judgment on himself. And he says his disciples have to count the cost. There is not a cost-free way of entering into the hopeful future. You actually have to die to self in order to be able to enter into the kingdom, and you have to follow him. And I think leadership often has to hold those three things together. It has to hold together a realistic diagnosis of what the problem is. It has to give people a vision and a hope for the future. But it also has to be absolutely honest about what the cost is and what it will take to get there. And I think actually people often want sort of the vision without the cost, without really facing up to the reality.
There's your sermon for Sunday.
Yeah, John for Prime Minister.
There we are. Excellent.
let's focus on integrity for a few minutes. So story this week, Rob Burrow, the rugby league sensation for Leeds Rhinos, passed away from motor neuron disease over the weekend. But there is a wonderful story that sits behind a life well-lived, a wonderful story of his friendship with Kevin Sinfield. There's a wonderful image of doing the Leeds Marathon.
That's right.
And Rob was pushed in a wheelchair by Kevin. And then Kevin lifted him out of his wheelchair and pushed him over and carried him rather over the finish line. Just incredible story of heroism, of friendship. And Rob Burrow's message was to live life every moment of it. He's died at the age of 41, but he leaves a huge legacy behind him. Lots of money raised for a cause of fighting this horrible disease.
Where do you want to start? Well, it's worth saying, by the way, that motor neuron disease is a particularly nasty disease. Yeah. It is a reminder we live in a broken world. Even this week we've had stories in the office of people in the FIC, the pastors who are sick, who are dying, who have died. It's just a reminder actually that there is an ugliness to this world, an unnaturalness about death and disease, which we need to mourn and long for a better day. But it is a moving story. That picture of being carried over the line at the Leeds Marathon had me in tears. You know, I think it is very moving. And I think that picture of friendship, I want to pick up on that. I think friendship is very, very marginalized in today's society. It's kind of, lots of friendships are superficial. They're not really deep in the way that you see biblical friendships work. I've been reading a book this week, a new book out by John Wyatt, talking about the friendships that John Stott had and how he benefited. John Wyatt benefited from that. And it just seems to me that these sort of deep friendships that actually have kind of Christian goals, missional goals behind them, they're purposeful, they require time and investment, those sorts of things seem to be lacking. And I think actually between these two rugby league players, you did see that. I think you did see something that was a bit deeper than just the superficial of normal life.
He kissed him as he carried him the line in that footage. It's extraordinary. It's this big burly rugby star. It does bring tears to the eyes. Yes. I mean, my uncle died of motor neuron disease in 2021. And I remember when he was first diagnosed, we were talking and I said to him, "How are you feeling, Neil?" Neil was a Methodist minister. And he said, I've asked God to heal me. I know he won't heal me, but he's asked me to glorify him for the rest of my life. Mm. And that was wonderful.
I mean, I do think the picture of being carried across the finishing line is a wonderful picture. And at one level, that points in two directions, doesn't it? At one level, that's actually what the Bible says we're to do for one another as Christians. You know, amongst us, there are those who are lame and we are to carry each other's burdens. And actually, we are to be those who get one another to finish the race. And I think there's a real sort of example of that there. But you might say supremely, of course, Jesus is the one who gets us to the end of the race, carries us over the line. He's the one who finishes it sort of for us. I think there's a sort of a really powerful picture there that points us to that. But I think just reflecting on a life well-lived and what that means as a Christian, I think we also want to say, although that's true at a human level, there is actually way more than that. That actually the finishing line for us is not the finishing line. That there is a sense in which actually eternity lies ahead. There's a new creation. There's a kind of a future to live for. And I think that as Christians, we don't have to live solely with the kind of make the most of your life now, live every moment to the full. There's a certain way that pans out if you don't really believe in the idea of eternity. And actually for us, we see our real life as being actually beyond the finish line of this life. Now, actually, we can commend good that anybody does in this life. In God's common grace, people can live good lives that benefit others, that do good things. But we believe that in a sense, in and of itself, that's not enough. There's actually an eternal future to be grasped. And as Christians, our hope in that shapes the way that we live now. That does mean we want to live to the full now, but living to the full now is basically following Christ wholeheartedly, serving his kingdom and his purposes, because we know
looking forward to eternity,
that will last into eternity. So the tragedy for human beings in a fallen world, we all face death, is that many live without that hope. You know, as Paul says, if there's no resurrection of the dead, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Yeah. And that is the way that many people choose to live. And we as Christians want to say there's way more than that. There's an eternity to come. Mm. We long for people to be able to enter into that eternity.
We don't know whether Rob Burrow was a believer or not, do we? I don't think so. We can't make a judgment on that, but yes.
Yeah. Died at the age of 41 last weekend. Let's spend this last couple of minutes talking about how you make tough leadership decisions. The England Euro 2024 squad has been announced.
Other nations are available.
Not Wales, who could only draw with Gibraltar last night, unfortunately.
Yes,
Bolton's Josh Sheehan captaining them to one of their worst performances in history. So,
but Scotland
Welsh
are in the
Welsh
Euros.
Fans were not very happy yesterday.
We ought to say.
We should. But tough decisions that you can only take a certain number of people with you. So he's dropped a couple of big names from his squad. Jack Grealish, Harry Maguire have not made it into the final.
He's added in a player who's been injured all year.
Yeah, exactly. And Luke Shaw. So it's quite interesting. But I guess the lesson here is leadership decisions are difficult, aren't they? And sometimes you have to take what others perceive to be unpopular decisions because you think it's the best for what's happening.
Interestingly, just as an aside before we get into it, he did call each of the individuals personally.
Oh, good on
Gareth Southgate.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
So I think that's quite nice, isn't it? That actually he didn't just announce a list and stand slightly aloof from it. Actually, he made sure that the people who were involved had some contact. They knew about it beforehand and all that kind of thing. And I think that's just, you know, I'm reading a book about the 60s, and it's a good reminder, actually, that Alf Ramsey in the 60s was the first England manager who was allowed to choose his squad. And in the middle of the World Cup...
The FA did it before.
Yes, and in the middle of the World Cup, there was a disagreement with the FA and because they did so badly in the group stages. And of course, we only remember the final, but they did so badly in the group stages that he was almost sacked by the FA because they wanted him to choose a different player. Anyway, that's by the by. Mm. You do have to make tough decisions, don't you, John?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One of all, so I say, by not picking them to play for England, he's not saying they're not being kicked out of football. It's not being excluded from everything. But there's obviously a limited number of people that will fulfill those roles.
Do you know how many, John?
I think there are 26. I think it's 26?
No, 23.
It's 23.
11 will play. I think I know that bit. But actually, again, that's true in church life, isn't it? There are certain things that need to be done and not everybody can do them. And you do have to make choices. You know, who's going to basically lead the music group? Who's going to basically doing the youth ministry? Who's going to be preaching. So you are making choices between people as to who should serve in particular ways. And that inevitably is often going to be a difficult decision to make. And I think there are a couple of things going on in the England choice. You have, on the one hand, deep loyalty to people who've served you for a long period of time, but somebody else is now perhaps more able, more gifted. Yeah. Somebody's become injured.
People who are very popular. Yeah.
People
in
are very
the country.
Popular. Do you keep them on just because of that loyalty? And loyalty is a good thing, but at the same time, the body as a whole suffers if you don't do that. I think one of the most difficult thing in church life is people who've been leaving ministries for a long time and have done a great job, but are no longer the right person to keep taking that forwards. But their identity and their value is bound up sort of in it. So yeah, I mean, those are hard people choices, and I think actually the nub of leadership is often about exercising hard and difficult choices, trying to make those wisely, fairly, kindly, transparently is a lot of what leadership is about. And that's actually the burden and responsibility of leadership, because in the end, choices will rarely please everybody.
Just coming back to Alf Ramsey, to make it really contemporary news. one of the things that interested me is I think one of the challenges we have as leaders, I mean, people will be listening to this and saying, I'd love to have a choice between people to lead the youth ministry, but frankly, I've only got one person who can do it. Or I'd love, you know, I think actually a lot of the dynamic in church leadership at the moment is struggling to get people. It's not having an abundance of riches. And actually, one of the things that Alf Ramsey did is he had to change the way that England played in the 66 World Cup, because he didn't have the players who could play the way that he wanted. So he had to adapt. You know, to quote the old proverb, he had to cut his coat according to the cloth. And I think there is something about that in terms of tough leadership decisions as well. You can't always do everything you want to do the way you want to do it, because actually you don't have the people to do it. And actually part of tough leadership is acknowledging that and recognizing that as well.
I was at a conference this week, and actually we were touching on this area, and one of the speakers were saying that in their experience, a lot of evangelical churches that close, that become small, it's not because they've drifted from the gospel. They've remained utterly faithful to the gospel truth, but actually over a period of time, the leadership has been unwilling to take the hard decisions that might be needed to change the ministry and enable the church to survive. And at one level, they go down faithful, but it's because of actually not wanting the cost and the pain of making tough decisions that would perhaps have offended people and would have caused some people to feel discomforted or distressed. And actually, out of a desire to keep everybody seemingly happy, actually you avoid taking the tough decisions. Yeah. But actually, the long-term result is the death of the church.
Will they win?
Pardon?
Will they win Euros?
Oh, absolutely no chance. We look forward to England's glorious failure in the latter stages.
I think they're going
to
win.
In the latter stages of the competition. That's my pronouncement. It can be played back to haunt me as we go forward.
I get fed up with hearing betting advertising on all the things I watch, but there's somebody who's offering a kind of 100-1 bet on England as a kind of thing to get you drawn in. I think if that's the betting odds they're offering.
Yeah, don't put your money on.
Can we use the FI series odds for that? Or is that
we cannot. That is clear.
And would not.
Time has gone, brothers. Good to talk about the news. If you've enjoyed the podcast, do rate or leave a review so others can find it. And we'll speak to you again soon.